Everybody ready to should we come to order here and talk about the monks again? Yesterday, for those of you who were here, I tried to develop a sort of trajectory or a way of looking at the present time, and my intention was to go back a ways into the middle 60s and by means of a series of stories or anecdotes or illustrations to try to portray the mindset or the attitude that dominated in particular times, so that we could get some perspective on our own time. And I wasn't able to finish that, and I'm not going to finish it today, but I will, I hope, before the week is out. But what I'd like to do today is just to do what was announced in the on the bulletin board over here, say something about the monastic worldview. I should say in the beginning that I'm not a monk, I don't think I have aspirations to become one, although I'm a little bit confused about that, but it would be impossible now. I'm not threatening to go out and join one of the orders, and I haven't spent a lot of time in these places. I visited a lot of monasteries, but never for more than a few days. So I'm really, I speak more from the perspective of someone who is on the outside looking in, rather than from the perspective of someone who's on the inside who can report about what goes on there. But the topic that I become fascinated with is not all that esoteric or eccentric any longer. We'll be hearing more and more about Thomas Merton. I mean, Thomas Merton has already become very famous just 10 years after he died in Bangkok in Thailand on December 10th, 1968. And in 1980, there will be a big festival someplace in the country honoring the birth of Saint Benedict of Nursia. And Benedict is the founder of Western mysticism, Western monasticism. And it was just 1,500 years ago, or just 480, that he was born. So if he were still alive today, he'd be 1,500 years old. And then we'd really have a celebration. So I've been hearing more and more about this kind of thing. Now, what I'd like to talk about today is same thing we were talking about yesterday, but in a slightly different way. Yesterday, we set up a basis for describing the mood of positive disengagement. And I think I suggested certain reasons why positive disengagement could come into prominence or vogue at the present time. And I also suggested along the way that positive disengagement can describe the mood that is prominent in monastic life, because monks are in a certain way, of disengaged from the world, but they don't see it as retreat or withdrawal or letting the world go its own way. They see this kind of disengagement as being positive, as being a positive response to the world. In fact, some of them will say that that one can relate to the world much more directly in that posture of disengagement, this sounds paradoxical, than in the kind of posture that most of us have to live by in the extra or non-monastic world. I have the same technique that I used yesterday. I have a couple of stories that I'd like to tell and then reflect on the stories. The first one is these are all autobiographical. I don't apologize for that very much because I'm just kind of talking about experiences I've had in these places. But it was in 1975, I think. I was teaching for a semester at Syracuse University in New York. And we had a group of students who were interested in monastic life, for a weekend anyway. And we took two cars, went down to Mount Savior Monastery near Elmira, New York. That's in kind of central southern New York. And let's see, we arrived there in the evening, right before supper, saw a couple of deer on the way, that doesn't have to be part of the story, but that's how I remember it. And they were very nice deer because the snow was falling. You could see the tracks kind of up into the hills there. And when I came into this monastery, I had some experience in places like this before, but the students, none of the students had ever been there at any time before. I would say the majority of them would profess no religion at all, although they were sensitive religiously. I don't think we had any Catholic in the group, or we may have had one or two, but it was sort of that kind of group, a group from university, not organized for religious purposes. And it was an entirely voluntary thing as well. We came into this place, and we were met by the guest master, who introduced himself as Brother Peter. And first of all, he told us he was glad we were there, took us over to a plaque on the wall, on which was inscribed a part of the rule of Saint Benedict, which is the sort of standard polity for the organization of monastic life. And he read from that rule, and read that aloud to us, so that we would be properly introduced to monastic life. And then he asked us if we'd say a prayer, or if he could pray with us, and there was no way to say no. We just, sure, if that's what we do here. So we kind of looked at each other, and then looked at the floor, and he said a little prayer for us after reciting this bit from Saint Benedict. My thought at that point is, I wonder what's going to happen next. And then he said, after he finished the prayer, he said, now, dinner is at 6 o'clock, after 8 o'clock we maintain silence here for, they call it the Great Silence, for a 12-hour period. And in order to tell us what that meant, he had to go on to say, that means no talking. No. And then he said, what do you plan to do while you're here? Just asked us that. Well, I had a few things I was thinking about doing. I brought a briefcase along and was a little bit behind in reading term papers. And I like to read term papers late at night because I don't like to spoil the best part of the day on term papers. And was thinking that might be a good way to spend the time. But I didn't think that belonged in the sequence of things that he had developed there, with the St. Benedict rule and the prayer and the announcement about dinner and then the discussion of silence. So none of us said anything. What do you plan to do here? We were already practicing the silence. And he said, I'd like to make a suggestion. He said, I'd like for you, while you're here, he said, you won't be here very long. He knew how long we were going to be there. You won't be here very long. He said, while you're here, try to do something that doesn't get you anywhere. He repeated that just one time. Try to do something that doesn't get you anywhere. And we didn't have to ask him what he meant by that. Well, we did finally. But that was a little bit of a shock. I was a little bit road weary anyway, driving down that far and thinking about trying to do something that wouldn't get you anywhere. You do a flip-flop on that. If you're trying to do something, you do something to get you somewhere. But how could you do something that wouldn't get you anywhere? Now, I thought about those term papers. And I was thinking about, just very quickly, I thought about all the things that I could conceive of doing, and everything that I could think of quickly was calculated in some way or another to get me somewhere. Now, I mean, just the things we do. If you're thinking about traveling from one place to another, that gets you someplace. If you're thinking about working, that gets you someplace, puts food on the table. You got to have salary or work to have income to pay the orthodontist bills. All those things get you someplace. And I couldn't, in 2 or 3 minutes there, I couldn't think of a single thing that I really wanted to do that wouldn't get me anywhere, except I thought about sleeping. But even sleeping could be designed to get you rest so that you could get up in the morning and do something. Knowing that the students, thinking that the students felt the same way that I did, I asked him, what would that ever be? What could we do while we're here that wouldn't get us someplace? And he says, said to me, why don't you just go take a walk or something? And at that point I thought, I'd like to have supper first. but I did take a walk the next day. thinking about his thing about doing something that wouldn't get us anywhere, and I saw one of the old monks out in the woods who was hauling wood on a wheelbarrow. There was an old, kind of rustic wooden wheelbarrow. He looked like he was having a hard time, so I asked him if I could help him. And he said, that'd be very nice, he said. So I helped him carry this pile of wood back to the place where he had a saw, not an electric saw, but the hand saw. And I spent about 2 hours there, got blisters on my hands, helping him saw that wood. And there I thought I'd violated it, because I had taken a walk. It was not calculated to get me anywhere. I saw this monk who seemed to need some help. Right away my mind was, well, let's help this man. Not only did I help him carry the wood, but I helped him saw the wood. And all the while I thought, this is a good thing to do, because these monks, winter's coming on here, it's going to be cold here, and they'll need the wood, they'll need the heat. And so I did do something that got somebody somewhere, and I hadn't done what the monk had asked us to do. I don't know what you make of that kind of a story. But we asked this brother Peter, following that time, what he meant by that. We had a little evaluation period at the end. And he went on to say that the monk lives a wasted life. That's what he wanted us to know. That they're not out there for utilitarian purposes. That pragmatism doesn't apply in the monastery. If we're going to evaluate monastic life according to pragmatic values, it just doesn't add up. And they somehow have to overcome the implicit criticism that they're of no use. They will admit that they are of no use. But then he goes on to say that you can't put a pragmatic kind of price tag or means of evaluation on prayer. So that's all they're out there to do, is to pray. And they pray for the world. But he said that they don't calculate in their minds that praying for the world is for the benefit of the world. It's not that. It's more that it's in their nature to pray. And when they pray, to use a phrase from Thomas Aquinas, they are doing what is in them. That is when the human being is acting in the way that the human being should. And I've thought about that example so many times that I've even developed a kind of theory about it. I know I'm overdoing this one, but I still would like to state it. The thought first came to me after reading C.S. Lewis's book on not the books where he does kind of evangelical religion, but the ones where he does medieval studies, where he suggests that for every era, every period of time, large period of time, there is a kind of single dominating theme, a theme around which all of life is organized. The theme is so prominent that one couldn't begin to understand the life, the culture of that period, unless you understood how that particular theme works. Now to give an example. He said for medieval times, the Middle Ages, that theme was image. Image was the dominant theme. And that meant that the visible world was a reflection of the invisible world, that this life was not an end in itself, but was a reflection of something beyond. Light becomes an important theme in that, or sub-theme in that world, because light goes together with image. The word mirror is another important theme, or important sub-theme, because it goes together with image. Luminosity is another one, to make things luminous and lumined, enlightened. All those kinds of words belong to the word image. And he even quotes from St. Bernard of Clairvaux, who does a lot with imagery. And Bernard of Clairvaux says, and has a statement that runs as follows, that when God looks into our souls, it is his own face that he sees. Now, that the soul should be a reflection or an image of the divine. Now, if you apply that kind of principle, Lewis's principle, to the modern age, and you ask that question, what is that fundamental kind of normative characteristic theme around which modern human life is organized? My suggestion is it's problem. Everything is problem, issue, problem. People will say no problem, but you know, when things are going well. But newspapers are full of accounts of problems. I've written all this down, and the trouble is when I write it down, I don't try to remember it any longer, but so I don't have very good examples here. But I'm thinking of things like agenda setting. If you think about how much of life is organized by agendas, agendas always, the items on an agenda always point to some conflict or some problem, but there's a great deal of life that is missed when problem solving is the approach to life. In fact, there's a wonderful analysis that has come out just in the last few weeks from the Brookings Institute in Washington by Henry Aaron. It's not the ball player who suddenly went intellectual and started worrying about world problems. It's another Henry Aaron who now works for the State Department. But he says that that what has happened in modern society is that in the early 60s, we had simple faiths to which motivated the war on poverty, which stood behind educational reform, which lay behind all sorts of things that were part of the inspiration of the Great Society. And then he says the analysts came along to figure out what was going wrong, and the analysts gave such elaborate, sophisticated evaluations of all these things that they ended up destroying the simple faith upon which those aspirations were built. So now you have a society, he says, it in conflict with itself, a society at odds with itself. Now, I don't want to go any further with that because we're talking about the monks, but what that the Brother Peter story says to me is that we are so much dominated by the problem-solving approach to human life that other things don't register. We put a kind of utilitarian value on all things, and unless we are doing something to get us someplace, see, unless we are working, you know, nobody has to give a good rationale for work. We all know that work is good. Play is hard to, sometimes difficult to sanction, or rest, or withdrawal, or disengagement, but work is good. Unless we can apply that kind of pragmatic assessment to things, we're not so sure that these such things are good. Let me tell another story, and then we still got to have some time, and then I'll give you a chance to respond. This story is the same kind of story that I've told before. It just makes the point in a different way. Again, I spend a lot of my time with students, and in fact, I learn more from students than many books, and I'm really taking advantage of what I learn from students. A lot of what I say is just things that come out of conversations that I have because of the privilege I have of being with young people a lot. We had another, this was in California, but we had another kind of student visit to a monastic place. And there was a time when the students could ask questions of one of the fathers. And I asked this question on the students' behalf, anticipating that they were thinking this, because they talk about this. I mean, they always want to know, what do they do about their sex life? And they want to know this kind of question. If these men had it to do over again, would they make the decision that they made earlier? I mean, knowing now, if they had known then what they know now, would they have done it? So I asked this older man. I gave him plenty of chances to, you know, get out of having to answer a question like that. But I said, if this isn't inappropriate to ask, you've been at this now for some 45 years, because he told us that. If you had your life to live over again, would you have done it? Would you have taken these vows? And he said that he had several brothers in his family, and they were all coming up to close to the age of retirement. And he was looking at their lives, looking at his life, and he thought that they had come out about even, he said. He wasn't ahead of them, they weren't ahead of him. He came out about even. But then, you know, then he got kind of excited, and he said, but if I had it to live over again, he said, there's one big change that I would make. And he said, this is the change. He said, when I was a young man, or a younger man, he said, I used to think that it took skill to be critical. And he said, now I realize that I could write 20 volumes of criticism of the church, and all 20 volumes would be accurate. He said, I could write 40 volumes of criticism of the country, and all 40 volumes would be accurate. But then he says he also realizes that that doesn't take any skill that's what everybody does. And that's how our minds, I'm adding here, but that's how our, what we're trained to do is to be critical, to practice the critical temper. Now he said, now I'm back to him, that little last two or three sentences are my own. He said if he had it to live over again, instead of being critical, he would have tried to be generous. Be generous. He says that takes skill. That's an art. That's something that is very difficult to learn. And then he sort of looked up to the sky, you know, like he was having a vision of some kind, or, I mean, he was telling us something that meant an awful lot to him, and he said the world is different if you see it through generosity. It's a different world than the world that is viewed through criticism. Now that's the kind of point that I'm after here, because the monks, I've been around monks long enough to, and I'm analytical enough, in fact that can do me in on more occasions than not, to try to penetrate, you know, what's going on there, what kind of mind would ever be attracted to this way of life. And I'm convinced that it has something to do with the difference between taking problem solving as an approach, taking criticism as a way of making one's way in the world, and being generous. Now, we can go further than that. We're not simply meaning that we shouldn't criticize, but we ought to think well of other people, although that's part of it. But I think the monks sort of build their strategy, and it is a strategy. I mean, they are doing this deliberately. They know what they're doing. They didn't just fall into it, most of them. They know exactly what they're doing. They've chosen that way of life. But they build their strategy on a very profound apprehension or feeling about sensitivity to things. And that is that the world cannot be penetrated through an attempt at instrumental control. As you can't, in other words, you can't work at life and make it come out right. You can't think your way through it. Even this phrase that we use so often, work it out. You can't work it out. They say you can't work it out, because when you work it out, you come to the world as though you were agent and it's some kind of thing over against you, and you're doing something to it to make it, to shape it right. Now that's a great part of the reason why Eastern religions have caught on in the West, I think, is because Eastern religions aren't plagued with that kind of thought. We don't do this in Eastern religions, but the Eastern religions of monasticism come very close on this one. They all say that it's the ego that gets in the way. You know, it's your desire, your attempt to carve out an existence that prevents you from penetrating, from seeing things as they really are. Now, over against this view that you can approach things by working it out or by exercising some kind of instrumental control, over against that view is the monastic view that like engages like. That you are not subject and the world is object, but you are of the same substance of that with which you have to deal. It's not that you are person and world is thing, or but that all of it is of the same nature. And before, you can't go over any further with this kind of thing without talking about the image of God. But the monk believes, I mean, and these kind of monks believe, they're all kind of Catholic, and Lutherans are Catholic in that sense too, I think, that man is made in the image of God. And though that has been, you know, the image of God in which man is made has been injured and tarnished and hurt and all that, those sorts of things, it still remains in some sense. It's still, man is still like that. And to engage the world is to come to terms with something which is very much like oneself. I have another way of talking about that. That's very difficult to talk about, and I didn't do it all that well. But I'm going to try another approach to it by citing an analogy. I don't know how many of you do this kind of thing, but I find that I've been doing it for a while, where if you stand back and away from reality or the world, if you can do that, you can do it here a little bit. We haven't been here quite long enough yet to do it, but if you're here for a while, you begin to get certain kind of images that can be useful in talking about, say, what is at the core of things, at the heart of things. Now the monks, you know, building on the position of Bernard of Clairvaux back in the 12th century, the monks come to have this kind of proposal, that if you could penetrate to the very core of reality, to the very heart of all things, whatever that would ever be, you would find, if you wanted to find language for that, you would find that that is much more like heart than like mind. It's not set of rules, it's not principles, it isn't that if you could ever do that kind of thing, and if you could come back, you know, and tell other people what you've discovered when you've been there, you wouldn't come back and say, I've discovered these truths about human life, because that's one step removed from that with which you have to deal. Rather, you'd come back with some kind of a song, probably, and it would be some kind of something that would look like something romantic, because you would discover that the world is like heart, most like heart. Now the monks say, I mean, in this kind of tradition that I'm kind of reflecting here, that God should be depicted as heart. God is a heart. If rather than rule giver, rather than simply creator of all things, rather than the one who upholds the laws, God is the one who loves, because heart loves. God is one who suffers, because hearts suffer. And they can, it take a long time to do this, but you can get very, very close. I mean, you can make the connections between seeing world as heart and understanding why it was necessary for Christ to suffer, because for Christ to suffer is part of the passion story. And the word passion applies to the story of Christ suffering, but also applies to the workings of the heart. And it's the same word in both times, and it probably applies in the same sense. Okay, I'm just about through with this, and I will give you a chance to respond, but I want to just sort of add one kind of final touch. Every religious tradition seems to be seems to get its foundations from a particular biblical book, I mean, within the Christian fold. Lutherans have been preoccupied with St. Paul's epistle to the Romans. I'm not going to add anything to that. I'm just going to say that. You know, somebody could say, well, we ought to add a little bit to that, and maybe not try James, but if you're going to go mystical here, you'd say, let's worry for a few years about the fourth gospel, John's gospel, see how that would kind of change the mix. But that's out of bounds. The monks, the monastic tradition, does not base itself upon the Epistle to the Romans, although I'm not even sure they always read the Epistle to the Romans, because it isn't very legal. They're not involved in kind of a juridical approach to the meaning of salvation. They don't have the throne room scene, for example, the judge and the sinner primarily. It's not that it isn't there, but it's that it isn't stressed. But the primary book for the monastic tradition is what we call the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs, or the Canticle from the Hebrew Bible, which is a Hebrew love story, a love poem, which talks about the way in which men and women, a man and a woman, have come to know one another. And that book is the most prominent book within the monastic tradition. There is I can give you all the scholarship on this if you could stand it, but I don't think we have to do that up here. But Bernard of Clairvaux began writing a commentary on those few pages of the Song of Songs, and he didn't finish the commentary in his own lifetime. He turned it over to his student, John of Ford, who couldn't finish it in his lifetime, turned it over to the next generation of Cistercian monks, and they couldn't finish it. You get up into the 16th century, you have St. John of the Cross. St. John of the Cross's most prominent book is the spiritual canticle, which is a commentary on the Song of Songs in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. And even up to the present time, somebody that Joe Barton probably knows well, Ernesto Cardinal, who's involved in this revolutionary struggle in Nicaragua, has written a book called To Live is to Love. And he was a Trappist monk in Gethsemane with Thomas Merton. And that book is, I was put onto that, told to read that book because it's a book that shows how a mystical tradition and liberation theology or theology of hope come together. It's the one place where it really does come together, that is in the writings of Ernesto Cardinal. And in that book, Cardinal does the same thing that Bernard of Clairvaux did way back in the 12th century. He offers a commentary on the Song of Songs, on that kind of ancient Hebrew love poem, which is really kind of uncanny. Now, I said I was done, and I am, but this is where I'm going to finish. For every one of these kind of religious movements, there is a particular worldview that seems to stand behind or is implicit in what is done and what is said. For example, those of you who are students of this know these things very well, the theology of Augustine is very Platonic in its orientation. The theology of Thomas Aquinas is very Aristotelian. And you find that pattern throughout Christian history. But the theology of monasticism, or mystical monasticism, is Pythagorean in its orientation. And Pythagoras was a Greek philosopher who said, first of all, that reality is number, and then talked about the music of the spheres. Everything, and Pythagoras had this wonderful vision of all these kind of interacting concentric spheres. There were cosmic spheres, there were natural spheres, and they made wonderful music. Now, the monk says, not all monks say this, but the kind of monk that I listen to says this, the kind of monk that I've created says this, that the goal is to create, not to create, you don't have to create it, because the creating it is getting back to that problem-solving thing where you're doing it, is to be able to hear the symphony that is already there, to be able to hear the music that is going on at all times. And there is harmony between the cosmic motion, and all the stars, the planets, all those wonderful things that you can see so brightly out here last night, and all the natural rhythms, all the natural patterns, all animals, trees, all those kinds of things, and the interior ones. And the interior ones are in harmony with all these things, and that's why it's music of the spheres. You can talk about kind of one melody which is being played in sort of stereophonic key, if you'd like, or something of that order. Richard Rolla, a mystic in the 13th century in England, says that, he felt that his heart was on fire. You know, he starts his little book by saying, I can't tell you how amazed I was when I felt that my heart was on fire. He said it was real warmth, too, but there was no pain. But then as he listened to it, you know, his heart on fire, he heard that there was melody coming from his heart. It was like his heart was singing a song, and he understood that song was in the same key as the kind of vibrations he was getting from his Lord, his God, this great heart of love. They were in harmony with one another. That's a major theme of monastic religion. So when the monk, the monk lives a very ordered life, it's very, very dependent upon the seasons, the hours of the day. It's very, very sensitive to natural patterns. The monk follows the word from the Old Testament about my soul waits for the Lord more than the watchman waits for the morning. He wants to be there when night gives way to morning. And they call that vigils. They're up very early in the day. They They greet the day. They don't want to miss the morning. They also don't want to miss the evening. And they do this, you know, round the clock, day after day. Your hands go like this all the time. Round the clock, day after day, they're doing the hours at very set times. Not when they feel like it, but always at an hour that has been announced, and they always start on time. And the life is regulated by the bells, by the liturgical calendar. And all of it is part of this conviction that there are natural, cosmic, and interior rhythms, and they are synchronized, they are harmonized. I suppose the final line here would be that that has become, I think, an alternative in the mid-20th century to the problem-solving approach to things. It's a very different way of living. It is certainly on the ascendancy. It's becoming more and more attractive to people because, in my view, problem solving has, you know, just about run itself out. Let's not poor mouth problem solving. I don't want to blow the whole thing by saying naughty things about that, because I want to give you a chance to respond if anybody would like to. Well, that's a very good question. Saint Benedict set up a. Let's go back a little ways. There was, when monasticism first began in the West, it began with a fellow named Saint Anthony, who lived in Egypt, and he was distressed about the decadence of city life. He went out into the desert and lived in a cave. He was, my son would say, weird. He had visions and dreams. One thing that's kind of interesting about him is he ate very little, sort of like John the Baptist, ate locusts and, you know, and no red meat, a lot of vegetarian things, and lived over 100 years, which is a great feat in those days, lived by himself. But he had these kinds of dreams. He would be thrashing around with the devil, with temptation. He had temptations about women. And the story goes that those things were so real for him that persons who would come within any kind of close distance of the cave could hear him thrashing around, and they actually thought he was in, and maybe he was, you know, in combat with somebody who was really there, like the devil, or like these things that he was fighting became personified. And anyway, you can't, we're getting to Benedict, you can't build much of an institute, or you can't institutionalize monasticism on that base. You can't come into a city and say, let's all go out and live like Anthony, go out there and thrash around in the caves, fight off devils and women. And so Benedict comes along a little bit later, and Benedict is responsible for establishing monasticism as an institution. And the rule of Saint Benedict is a sort of the regulations about how life in the monastery should be ordered. It talks about what kind of offices there should be, like the abbot and the others, the guest master. Also talks about how long a guest can stay. It defines what prayers should be said at what times, what offices should be said, things of that kind. And it has become the basis for Western monasticism. There's another kind of thing that I find interesting about Benedict is that in the popular mind, monasticism is understood as something that's sort of far out or without any utilitarian value. I've been kind of suggesting that that's the way they want to be understood. But as it turns out, you know, monasticism in the West was the means by which classical culture was transmitted into the Middle Ages. The monks were the ones who copied the texts, who stored the great works of art that were kept from that period of time, custodians of art, of classical art, Greco-Roman art and culture. If it hadn't been for the monks, well, nobody knows, you can't, it's all hypothetical to say if it hadn't been for them, but they were the ones who did the cultural work at that time. Now, I'm expanding on a one-sentence question to add a little something more, but the same thing is happening in the 20th century, happening right now. The monks, once again, are playing a key role in sorting out these currents that come from east and west, where east is meeting west. There's been a sequence of activity in that area. First step was that Westerners, primarily young people, who understood that Western religion was primarily idea, theoretical, thought, intellect, head stuff, discovered an alternative in the East, you know, in India primarily, which was not head, first of all, but had something to do with interior awareness, sensitivity. And second stage is that they go there. Well, that's first stage. But by this time in that sequence, a lot of those folks have come home and have brought back the illumination that they received there. And when they come back, they look for equivalents in our culture to what they found there. And so most of us, you know, have not been trained to look at mystical literature in the West. I had one of the finest educations that anybody could have in this area. I did it for 10 years, and I'm not bragging here, I'm just getting an illustration. I went through Yale University, where it was understood that they had the best program in the history of theology anywhere in the country. I think that's true. Well, it was true then, probably still is true. We didn't have any training, even though I majored in this area. We had no training in the medieval mystics. We had training in the medieval theologians, but not in the spiritual writers. And that was just something everybody overlooked until the spiritual writers were discovered in the East, in traditions outside the West. And then once that sensitivity was created, those people came back to the West and looked for the same thing here. The way I like to talk about that is that the West is now facing the West. See, we're looking at ourselves, but we're facing ourselves from the East. We've incorporated interests that have been cultivated in the East to enable us to penetrate resources that are maybe available in the West. And in the kind of Benedictine style of keeping cultural traditions alive, the monks are serving in the capacity of sorting out these East-West cultural currents. And they're doing that better than anyone else. Anyone else want to? Thank you.
The monastic life associated in some formal organized way with the Catholic Church, or is it?
Well, yeah, these are excellent questions. I'm not even clear. Yeah, most of them are Catholic, but the only monks that I've gotten to know well have said, first of all, we're monks. And secondly, we're Catholic. Most of them are not priests. I'd always thought that monks were priests. I don't know why I thought that. But most of them are not. In a group of about, say, 40 monks, there's a wonderful monastery, where is this now, south of here, Lafayette, Oregon, near Salem, a Trappist abbey, a monastery called Our Lady of Guadalupe. And there are probably 40 monks living there. And among those 40, there, I would guess maybe 8 or 9 are priests, ordained as priests. Of course, it's Catholic. There are some Episcopalian monasteries in this country, the Order of Holy Cross. And there's one Lutheran one up in Oxford, Michigan, I guess, but it's a very small one. I haven't been to that. It's not Catholic. I can't generalize here, but it's not Catholic in a very parochial way. Doesn't seem to me. It's more that I have a feeling that this is where those folks who wanted to live a monastic life find a home.
They wouldn't have a priest in residence.
There'd always be a priest there because they say the Mass every day. But they don't have to be a priest to be a monk.
I was having an image as you were talking of when in our normal lives do we have that kind of cycle of hours and things. And it seemed like the only thing I could think of was infants or very young children that haven't yet gotten into our problem, that live closer to responding to natural suffering.
Well, I don't think most of us there'll be a chance to become, or would even be a desire to become a monk. I certainly, if anybody told me 5 years ago I'd be talking about this today, I wouldn't have believed it, but maybe they would make a statement like that. But for most of us, it may be a temporary thing, but I think there's a greater interest than before in doing it on a temporary basis, like over a weekend. I had the experience not so long ago of going. I taught a course at PLTS in Berkeley during the summer on this very subject. We did 3 weeks on the theme, the contemplative era. A lot of it was about Thomas Merton, and a lot of it was about the mind of the monks. And we spent, this group of 15 Lutheran pastors, and I'm not a pastor, but I'm Lutheran, spent the 24-hour period at the Trappist Abbey in Vina, California, which is right south of Red Bluff, south of Redding. That's another really fine place. All these places are open for visitors, and most are open for retreatants if you're male. And they have a difficult time. Some of them are open now to women, but most of them are not yet, but they will be. And at this particular place in Vina, we were allowed, which is kind of a rare thing, I think, we were allowed to sit in the choir in the monastery. We tried to live for 24 hours like monks. Of course, we all knew that was kind of fakey. You can't come in there and just, you know, put on the monk suit and pretend you're going to be a monk. But we thought in grand kind of empirical enlightenment era problem solving way, we want to test this and see what it feels like. We liked it a great deal, but for the first, we had trouble with the initial silence period. Silence comes right after. They have vespers, then they have supper, then there's a period of about an hour following supper for work if they haven't finished work or whatever else anybody wants to do. Then there's compline, and at compline gets darker and darker. They try to time this so it comes right following sunset, or right as the sun is moving. So when you leave compline, it's dark outdoors. And there's just a little bit of a candlelight inside the chapel. It's all very aesthetically fine, I think. And it's Gregorian music in many places, although they too have been affected by the guitars. Well, our group had great difficulty with the silence right after that compline. And I remember one fellow came up to me. I'm not making fun of him, because this was his first exposure, and I would have done this the first time. But he says, "Isn't there anybody around here to discuss anything with?" Yeah. And he really wanted to talk. And he went around to the group and sort of tapped our group people on the shoulder to see if they would talk. And it just happened that the telephone rang. And he went around and told everybody. He says, "The telephone's ringing." He says, "I don't know why that telephone's ringing, but the telephone's ringing." Of course, by that time, none of us really cared why the telephone was ringing, and the telephone rang on and on and on. We had a difficult time with the silence, but we were invited to sit in the choir with the monks, that's what I was about to say. That's a rare privilege, I think. There'd be one monk, and then one of us, and then another monk. And this kind of singing that went back and forth, from the antiphonal singing from the one side and answered by the other, it's kind of ebb and flow like this. And the comments that our men made afterwards was that Lutheran singing, by contrast, is very aggressive. They learned that this was soft, and they liked it, and it flowed back and forth. How did I get onto that? What did you ask me? Yeah, I don't know. Yes. Pardon me? Oh, they do a lot with vegetables, and they try to live off the land. They're very ecologically, environmentally aware. They raise a lot of their own crops there. I think they have a lot of peanut butter and homemade bread. That's great. Somebody over here had a.
Yeah, I have a question.
Oh.
I lived with a bhikkhu for 3 weeks as part of a, for those of you who don't know, bhikkhu is a Buddhist monk, mm-hmm. as part of my undergrad training, I've been working with all religious. And I'm just really amazed hearing you talk about about the striking similarities between the lifestyle and between the, a lot of the things that the motivation between, oh, why things are done, et cetera, et cetera. Was there some point, you know, back in the early stages of monasticism where there was, were there dialogue with these that was intentional, or is these systems just kind of grow up totally independent of each other?
That's a very good question, too. We've had a series of nice questions this morning. All of them enabled me to do what I'd like to do. my feeling on that is that monasticism is a kind of universal characteristic of religion, and it's going to be about the same wherever you find it. And it isn't that they learn from one another, although they do learn some things from one another. When Thomas Merton went to Asia, he said he wanted to visit the Buddhist monks because he said in matters of spirituality, they are far ahead of us. They know more about this. Let me switch it just a little bit. It's still an open question, but if you worry at all about the roots of religion or whether religion can be explained in terms of something else, I guess I'll just have to say I got into this because I wrote the article on religion for the World Book Encyclopedia. And it's the most difficult job I've had because I had to try to write this to somebody who was in the sixth grade. And see, I can fool around a lot when I do what I do, talking to college people. They're all usually attentive. They're a captive audience because they take the thing for a grade and you test them at the end. But to try to explain religion to write it so clearly that a sixth grader could get it and wasn't forced to read this stuff was really a challenge. And I came to the view that that mysticism is sort of one of the roots of religion, rather than the other way around. It isn't that mysticism is a kind of a characteristic of religion, but mysticism is something that is definitely human, but something upon which religion draws. And we've had a lot of that in Lutheranism. But in Lutheranism, it has become—I'll get in trouble on this, but I really don't care anymore. It's become pietism, and pietism is too narrow. See, pietism has lost the large base that mysticism ought to be able to include, and then it becomes, well, pietism turns out to be a divisive force within the church. It pits one group against another group. And anyway, what I'm suggesting is that mysticism is a kind of universal religious category. And these monks, whether they're Buddhist or Christian, they'll know that they have a tremendous amount in common because it's self-reflective, it's introspective. And if they're going to be introspective, they're not going to come up with different versions of the self. They may have different interpretations of what they come up with, but they're going to come up with similar things. And that this is occurring now also, that in Spencer, Massachusetts, at the largest, no, not the largest Trappist Abbey, the largest one is Gethsemane, where Thomas Merton was, St. Joseph's Abbey in Spencer, Buddhists and Christians have met together there for, you know, 3 or 4 days at a time and are sharing secrets about spiritual practices, and they get along very well. That's the exciting thing to me on the ecumenical front. Yes?
What is it in problem solving? I think in which I just don't have. In this Pythagorean harmony of mm-hmm. all the spheres, where's the natural cosmic harmony of women?
Oh, heck. that's where it's going to come back. I'm a little bit scared to say what I know about that. You know, if I had been here a little longer and knew this group a little better, I mean, I'm being very, very candid, I would have told the story about Mother Miriam down at Redwoods. See, the monks are not all men. There are a lot of women around who are living a monastic life. And there's a monastery that in Northern California, where Lois and I and the children have visited, where they are putting together Christian spirituality on a kind of Bernard of Clairvaux base, with mind being like heart rather than mind, I mean reality being like heart rather than mind, with C.G. Jung's psychoanalytic approach to things. In the couple of minutes that I have left, I'll just say that we came into there a couple of years ago, sat down with this nice abbess Mother Miriam, about whom I'd heard a great deal. And she said to us, or to me, that they had had a very profound experience at that place that day. There was one of the women there who had come to a time of psychological breakthrough and religious awareness all in the same day, all in the same event. And then she said, and what is more, all of us knew it. All of us knew it. And then she looked at me to see if I was still there and said, she said, it has caused me to think about Christ the archetype the whole day. And I wasn't prepared for that. I've been driving this car down that highway. And she said, does the word archetype bother you? I said, no, the word archetype doesn't bother me. I said, I'm not sure what you mean by Christ in this context. And then we began talking about Mary as archetype. Gee, the whole world was just, I mean, the world was just full of stuff that she'd been thinking about on that. And well, because there's only a minute left, this kind of religion is very much more feminine oriented than masculine. Problem solving is a masculine technique. It's agential. This Pythagorean thing of the harmony is, you know, in the words of David Bacon, that's on the side of communion. It's on the side of, if you want to line it up this way, it's much more mother-oriented than father-oriented. That would take another session, but I see that as being one of the ways in which the feminine dimension will return. And I think the religion of the 80s will be much more that way because of the power of womanhood, because the power of womanhood registers in that context. I'm not saying this as well as I could, I think, if I had more time, but I realize that the time is up. But all of that belongs to the same kind of mix. I guess the end result of that would be that there'll be more and more interest, even among Lutherans, in the person of Mary, the mother of Jesus, also, in some sense, the mother of God. Johann Tauler, who was somebody who influenced Luther a great deal, said that there were three births of Christ. Luther says good things about Tauler. And the first birth of Christ was when it was the birth that occurred within the Trinity, when the Son proceeded from the Father. The second birth of Christ is when Christ is born of Mary, that particular woman, and God becomes incarnate in human form. The third birth of Christ is in the human soul. And there, if you think about the third one, and for those medieval figures, it was the third birth of Christ that was given the most emphasis. They can talk about the soul as being like mother, like woman. Oh, we need more time on that. But that whole tendency is very, very strong in the kind of orientation that I hope I've been depicting and describing today. Thank you for your attention.